Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Monday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the HD View. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1, and our awesome producer, James, will cue you into the show. Please tell all your friends and family and colleagues about Help for HD, the HD View. Click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes, and you can listen to the show right from your iPhones and Androids. We are literally at almost 16,000 listeners now, thanks to you, our amazing listeners. Huntington's disease, HD, is a hereditary and terminal disease which destroys neurons in the brain and slowly diminishes the affected person's ability to walk, talk, and reason. In time, they will rely completely upon others for everything. HD devastates entire families emotionally, psychologically, socially, and economically, generation after generation. Every child of someone with HD has a 50% chance of inheriting the gene mutation for both HD and JHD. Juvenile Huntington's disease, JHD, is more rapid and virulent. They do experience many additional traumatic symptoms like decline in scholastics, adverse behaviors, seizures, dystonia, and other very severe and painful conditions. Our JHD warriors need much, much more support and resources. Tonight, our incredible distinguished guest is the esteemed Steve Finkbeiner, MD, PhD. He is Senior Investigator and Associate Director of Neurologic Research at the Gladstone Institute of Neurologic Disease, or GIND, G-I-N-D. He is also the Director of the Tabe Kare Center for Huntington's Disease Research at Gladstone and the Hillman Family Foundation Alzheimer's Disease Research Program. He is also a professor in neurology and physiology at the University of California, San Francisco, that's UCSF. And Dr. Finkbeiner studies the molecular mechanisms that are responsible for learning, memory, and neurodegeneration. A better understanding of the mechanisms that control memory formation in neurons will yield crucial insights into the development and progression of neurodegenerative diseases and the memory disorders that often characterize them. We are so honored to have Dr. Finkbeiner with us tonight, and we'll be right back after this quick break, and welcome to the HD View. Thank you. are back. We are so honored to have Dr. Finkbeiner with us tonight. And, you know, my sister actually got to meet him at the San Francisco HD Symposium that was in February. So I wish I could meet some of these guys, but I can't. And Dr. Finkbeiner, we are extremely honored to have you on the program this evening. I do want to preface our first question to you because we've had quite a number of emails, at least over 50 emails about the subject, and many people in the HD community have questions about this drug, which is being marketed for chorea, tetrabenazine or xenazine. There seems to be a lot of confusion about it, and people are under the impression that it's slowing their progression. But reading the black box warnings on the Lundbeck marketing materials, they do state that xenazine can cause depression, suicidal thoughts, suicidal actions, further warning that people should not start taking xenazine if they are depressed or have untreated depression that is not well controlled by medication, and not to mention psychiatric nervous system and other side effects people are questioning. And so I thought maybe Dr. Finkbeiner would be able to answer, you know, some of these questions. Aren't these the symptoms of Huntington's already? And can you speak to the subject, Dr. Finkbeiner?
Sure. So first of all, thank you very much, Melissa, for having me on your show.
You're welcome.
I'm really pleased to be part of it. So tetrabenazine, I'm sure many of your, oh, I should say too beforehand, I have no relationship with Lundbeck. So, I'm sure many of your listeners know tetrabenazine or xenazine is the first FDA approved drug for Huntington's disease. It's been used for quite a while in the United Kingdom, but it took a while to get it approved here in the United States. It's thought to work by reducing some of the neurotransmitter chemical release of neurons in the brain that are responsible for generating chorea, the extra motor movements that occur in Huntington's disease. And so by reducing the amount that gets released, it's thought that is how it helps control some of the chorea symptoms. The issue of disease progression is a difficult one, and just so your listeners understand, we try to make a distinction when we think about therapies about whether they're working on just the symptoms or whether they're actually affecting the underlying progression of the disease. It's a little bit like getting a cold and taking, for example, a decongestant. It only kind of helps the symptom. It doesn't actually help you get rid of the cold faster. It's your own body that does that. Whether tetrabenazine affects disease progression is really still not known. The assumption has been that it's primarily a symptomatic therapy based on the way we think it works. But there have been at least two studies in mouse models of Huntington's disease, preclinical models, where someone has suggested that it might actually slow progression. It'll take a while before that question is resolved. I can just tell you from my experience in another disorder, Parkinson's disease, that affects the same chemical in the brain, but in that case, there's too little that's released normally. There's a drug that's used in that condition, and there was discussion for many, many years about whether that drug affected disease progression, and it wasn't until maybe, I don't know, many, many years after it was used before that was really resolved. So I think at this time it's safe to assume that the drug at least helps with the symptoms. Certainly it's been shown in a clinical trial that it affects, it improves chorea. But we just don't know about actual disease progression. And you asked a question about side effects. And certainly depression is a very common feature of Huntington's disease. And it has been shown in clinical trials of the drug that it can, for some people, make those symptoms worse. So it is something that we have to pay very close attention to because depression, when it's very severe, can be very, very difficult. And so if anyone is taking the medication and feels those symptoms, it should be something that they talk about with their neurologist to make sure whether the benefits of the drug really outweigh some of these side effects.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there reports being sent to the FDA regarding this drug? Do you know?
Well, whenever a drug is approved and is out for use, there's always a degree of monitoring that goes on of its use. So if there are adverse events, then the FDA does collect those reports.
Okay. Now, if any of our listeners out there have questions regarding this topic, please feel free to call in. And also, just to let you know, I did send out invitations to people from Lundbeck and HDSA and CHDI, those people. So if they would like to call in and make mention of anything, that I'd sure like to open that up to them. But looks like we don't have any questions right now. We may have some coming up in the next few minutes or so. But so let's move on. And I've noticed, I listened to the symposium that you did in February, and you talked about something called the Valley of Death in drug development world. Can you explain that and what happens in drug development?
Sure. So much of the basic research into how diseases work is supported with funding, at least in the United States, from a government agency called the National Institutes of Health. And so, in particular, there's a institute called the Institute of Neurological Disease and Stroke, National Institute of Neurological Disease and Stroke, that is the main supporter of Huntington's disease research. And when scientists do research into Huntington's disease, they're often using simple models, cells and mice, to try to really understand how the disease occurs so that we can come up with strategies that might become the basis for developing a therapy to treat Huntington's disease. The challenge has been that it's quite a few steps between discovering something that looks promising in an academic laboratory and developing a drug that actually works for patients in the clinic. And it's really that in-between area that we call the Valley of Death. And it's given that name for a number of reasons. One is that, and this isn't even specific to Huntington's disease, but is something that's relevant to a number of neurodegenerative or neurological diseases. It turns out that we've had, and by we, I mean the scientific community, have had a harder time being able to translate results from discoveries that we make in mice to results that in people in clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
And some of your listeners may resonate with that. They may have, for example, heard reports of this or that therapy really making a difference in a mouse model of Huntington's disease and then not really hearing anything about it later and wondering what happened. And in a number of cases, what's turned out is that some of the therapies that seemed to look so promising in mice either turned out to have some bad side effects that prevented them from being tested in people, or they didn't really show much of an effect in people. And so it's been frustrating in that regard. And so it means that trying to develop drugs for Huntington's disease in particular and neurodegenerative diseases more broadly is a risky effort. Some of the discoveries that we make many of the discoveries we make don't translate when we get to human clinical trials. And the big challenge is that the trials that we need to perform in order for the FDA to give approval for a drug are really expensive. Part of that is because the Huntington's disease, the symptoms unfold fairly slowly. That means that we have to follow people for quite a while to really know whether the drug's working or not. And the other is that, and this is improving, but the sorts of tests that we can perform on patients to see if their symptoms have improved or not are not super sensitive, and that means that we often also have to follow a fairly large number of people in a clinical trial to really know for sure whether what we're doing is having a beneficial effect. And so those two factors make clinical trials for neurodegenerative diseases unusually expensive. And so it's really those two features, the fact that the results that we sometimes discover in the lab don't always hold up when we get to a clinical trial, and the fact that the clinical trials are so expensive makes this an area where when a company wants to try to develop a drug, they really have to be willing to risk quite a bit of investment before they actually know whether they've got something. And unfortunately, that has caused some companies to avoid working in the area of neurodegenerative disease because they feel like it's too risky.
Mm. So that's kind of a double whammy, because you've already got issues with coming up with the trials or studies, and then you have people that don't want to invest. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. And wow. it's hard to find financial support for those really early stage steps in drug development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because ideally, maybe with enough testing, we could show that a particular idea or a therapy really does deserve to be tried in a clinical trial. But it's sometimes really hard to sort of take that discovery from your academic lab and actually move it far enough along to show to potential companies that this idea really deserves to be tested. So it makes that challenging. So as a consequence, it gets called the Valley of Death because there are a lot of ideas that look really promising, but they never really make it down to through the valley. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then with the economy, too, kind of crashing, that hasn't helped, right?
No. It's been actually a triple whammy in that respect. Because,
right.
Because as anyone who follows the government's aware, the depressed economy has meant that the federal budget is more constrained, and so NIH doesn't have the support that it hasn't been able to grow, so that's affected academic research. Foundations and donors have obviously been affected too, so that they have less support available, and some of the drug companies too are struggling. Some of their drug pipelines have thinned out recently and have gone off patent, and so the financial support they have available for doing research and development or even really taking some risks is more limited, and so it's been challenging.
Yeah, well, we know that HDSA stopped funding in 2009, and NIH has been not funding as much, right?
Yeah, it's been pretty flat, and they've been also a little worried too, because I don't know if you've followed the news, but there's at least at the moment the plan that if they can't achieve the budget, this is the federal government, can't achieve the budget savings that they want, they're going to implement something called sequestration, which is an across-the-board budget cut that will affect the NIH as well. And since NIH already has some ongoing commitments, that means that new research will be particularly hard hit.
Mm-hmm. Right. And do you have any connection with CHDI, or I don't know if you're working on stem cells now, but I think you are, aren't you?
Yeah, we have a paper that'll be published in August. We're part of a consortium for Huntington's disease induced pluripotent stem cells. So these are special stem cells that you can make by taking a skin sample from an adult and reprogramming those cells to be skin cells. And there are lots of ideas about how those stem cells might be useful for Huntington's disease therapeutics. One of the things that we're trying to do is to see if we can use them as a tool to find therapies that are more likely to work in clinic than the ones that we've developed just relying on mouse models. Anyway, there's a paper that will be published in August in Cell Stem Cell that describes this platform. It's part of a consortium of labs, including Jim Gazzella, Marcy McDonald, Leslie Thompson, Chris Ross, Clive Svensson, and then a number of investigators at CHDI also brought in to be part of this consortium.
Good. Now, I did hear a funny story about how you obtained the first human skin cells. I think it was from your dad.
Yeah, that may be another person.
No? Okay.
Not me.
I thought it was you. I heard another symposium a while back, and he was saying that he was at dinner with his dad, and he had a little, I don't know, catheter or something, and just kind of popped his dad's hand. Okay, now we have the first skin cells.
Yeah, well, it is pretty easy. We have a little device that's about the size of a ballpoint pen that takes a little skin sample, and you can
take those back
to the laboratory to make stem cells. So it is a remarkable technology.
That's great. And that's the induced pluripotent stem cells, right?
That's right.
From the skin. Yeah, that's funny. Okay, can you tell us about the common thread strategy in your lab? Because you mentioned something about that.
Yeah, so... you know, Huntington's disease, we have lots of challenges. So we have the challenge I just mentioned to you about the valley of death, which applies to all neurodegenerative diseases. But then on top of that, Huntington's disease, though it's devastating for families that are affected by it, still affects fewer people than, for example, Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. And so on a practical level, the challenge that that creates for us is that because these clinical trials sometimes can cost $50, even $200 million, we really need to find industry partners who will work with us to take and develop these therapies so that we can go all the way to clinic. And it's hard sometimes to get companies interested if the number of patients that are affected isn't large enough, to be honest. And so one of the things that we've been thinking about is there a way... at my institute, we work on a number of neurodegenerative diseases, including Huntington's. So also we work on ALS and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And we've noticed that as we've studied some of these other diseases, that in some cases there are commonalities. So in all these diseases, we've noticed that there are abnormal proteins that deposit in the brain. And so maybe therapies that would be aimed at helping to bolster the brain's ability to clear misfolded proteins could be a strategy that works for Huntington's disease, but it might work for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS as well. In fact,
right.
We've even found some small molecules that do just that. And so if that's the case, then it's a little bit easier for us to have a conversation with an industry partner because we can say, well, you know, this drug, we may have discovered it while studying Huntington's disease, but it seems to be effective for some of these others as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps us a couple of ways. One is that it's probably a little less risky because now we've shown that it works in several models, so maybe if that increases the chance that it'll work once we take it to the clinic. And the fact that it might work in something that affects multiple diseases means many patients. That makes it more interesting, too, for the companies. And as you can imagine, this whole effort is fairly resource-intensive, and so I think it's attractive to donors, too, because it means that someone who might be just interested in Alzheimer's could help share some of the costs with people who are just interested in Huntington's disease, and maybe together we can achieve something that neither of us could achieve by ourselves. So we're sort of hopeful that this might be a way to help us because some of the steps are things that only need to be done once. So if it works for multiple diseases, it's costs we can share. So maybe this could be an effective way to, pool our precious resources and to be able to develop more things and develop them farther and hopefully in the end really get support from industry partners so that we'll be able to put things in clinic and hopefully have more things to offer people.
Combine effort, kill two birds with one stone, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Or several birds.
Yeah.
Dr. Finkbeiner, I hope you don't mind if we back up just a bit. Apparently we have little Blog Talk Radio gremlins here and there, and some people didn't hear our first question. They had to refresh and restart their show box. So do you mind if we get back up and kind of revisit the Zenazine question again?
Sure.
Okay. And for those of you who didn't hear the first part of the questions, we were talking about Zenazine and the fact that there seems to be some confusion about it in the community. Some people are under the impression that it's slowing their progression, but then reading the black box warnings on the Lundbeck's marketing materials, they state that Zenazine can cause a plethora of symptoms or side effects, depression, suicidal thoughts, suicidal actions, that kind of thing. And so, Dr. Finkbeiner, if you could just kind of reiterate a little bit about what we were talking about. Some of these are symptoms of HD already, so the warnings are, you know, there to indicate that there is an issue with depression and that kind of thing.
Sure. So what I said before was that Zenazine's been used already for a number of years in the United Kingdom and Great Britain, and it wasn't until recently, though, that it got approved for use in the United States. So it's a new drug to us, but it's not a new drug in general, and there has been quite a bit of experience using the medication. It seems to work by reducing the amount of neurochemical that gets released in the brain that's involved with generating those extra movements, chorea. The neurochemical is called dopamine, and so it's thought that when you take this medication, less of that gets released, and that reduces the amount of extra motor movements that get generated. You'd asked a question about disease progression, and so when we think about medicines to treat diseases, we try to make a distinction between medicines that treat the symptoms of those diseases and medicines that actually treat the underlying cause or pathogenesis of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's too early to tell, I think, whether Zenazine affects disease progression. We can say with certainty that it at least affects the symptoms, and based on what we know about how it works, that's probably how we would expect that it works.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been a couple reports from academic basic science laboratories studying mice that are designed to model Huntington's disease that suggest it might have an effect on disease progression. It's a much harder question to answer definitively in people. It mm-hmm. usually takes many, many years of study and use of the drug to really be able to answer that question. So I think, unfortunately, we're just going to have to wait to get that question resolved.
Right.
But then you asked the question about the symptoms of depression.
Right.
So depression is a common, very common symptom in Huntington's disease, and it does seem to be genuinely a feature of Huntington's disease. That is to say that that it's not just depression about Huntington's disease. Depression seems to be part of Huntington's disease very frequently. And it was shown in clinical studies that although this is a common symptom, it did seem to be more common or in some cases worse for patients taking Zenazine. It doesn't happen to everyone, and so a really important thing for listeners who might be on this medication is to just be aware that this is a potential side effect, but it's a really important side effect, and so it is something that if you're experiencing those symptoms, you do want to talk to your neurologist or primary care doctor who might be giving you the medicine to make sure that at every point that the benefits of the medication truly outweigh any of the potential downsides, because every medicine has some side effects, and it is something we have to think about.
Okay, we do have a question. James, do you want to ask the question? Hello?
There I go. Do you hear me?
Okay,
sorry, I've got five screens open in front of me.
Okay.
Yes, doctor, this question comes from Facebook community member in chat. Her name is Lynn. I was looking on a few websites about tetrabenazine. Some places say it is a treatment. So is this a legitimate treatment? Because I'm confused because we've been told that there's no treatment. Thank you, Lynn.
Yeah, so I think a little bit has to do with the word treatment. And this was getting at the comments I made earlier about the difference between something that treats symptoms and something that affects disease progression. A drug can be a treatment if it helps patients manage the disease better. At this point, what we can say about tetrabenazine is that it's a treatment of symptoms, so it helps for sure with the motor movements for many people. But we don't know whether it's a treatment in the sense that it affects disease progression. I don't think we have a good answer for that yet. And based on how we know the drug works, the likelihood is that it's primarily affecting symptoms and maybe not disease progression. But we don't know yet. It could be helping with disease progression too. We just don't know.
I know. I have a question about that actually. You had mentioned that it was a treatment in UK or was it Canada? I forget.
Well, it definitely was approved in the UK. I do know that.
Now, did they have a different formula of the medication, or is it the same that we have here?
You know, to my knowledge, it was the same. But
okay. Then didn't we have any clinical trials with it, or?
Yeah, there was a clinical trial done by the Huntington Study Group that was published in Neurology in 2006. And it was really in that clinical study that they showed that it had a significant effect on chorea. Mm-hmm. And they quantified the amount by which the chorea was reduced. Mm-hmm. And that was also, they noted that sometimes it can amplify the risk of depression or suicidal thoughts, which is something we talked about before, too.
Right. All right. Well, I don't know if we had any other questions about that, but I'm sure that people will type their questions in as time goes on. Real quick, I want to move on to the next question that I had. It was regarding your assistant sent me an article in Gladstone News, October 30, 2011. It's regarding what you have discovered about misfolded protein and neuronal death. Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Okay.
So the underlying cause of Huntington's disease is a genetic mutation that leads to a change in the number of nucleotides in the Huntington gene in a particular region, and that gene encodes a protein called Huntington, and the change to the gene leads to an abnormal number of glutamines, which is an amino acid in the Huntington protein. So normally there's a region of that protein that has a stretch of anywhere between 4 and 35 glutamines. The most common stretch length is about 17, but anything above 35 puts a person at risk for Huntington's disease, and above 40 generally means that person will develop Huntington's disease if they live long enough. And the longer that stretch is, in general, the earlier that individual tends to develop symptoms, though there's quite a bit of variability, particularly in the sort of range of 40 to 50, which is the length that most people with HD have. So people have wondered for some time, what is it about having too many glutamines that gives you Huntington's disease? And I think the first clue was that when we looked at brain tissue from people with Huntington's disease, we meaning the scientific community, people observed that there were abnormal deposits of proteins in neurons. And these deposits contained huntingtin as well as some other proteins. And as people looked into that more, they discovered that this having too many glutamines in the huntingtin protein made it prone to aggregate with other molecules of huntingtin and with some other proteins in the cell. And so I'd say a major idea in the Huntington's disease field for some time has been that there's something about that propensity to aggregate that may trigger neurodegeneration and Huntington's disease. And part of the reason for thinking that, too, is that we've noticed in other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS, we also see abnormal protein aggregation and deposition. So there's been this idea that maybe this is a common feature of adult onset neurodegenerative diseases. And that's part of the reason, too, for thinking that maybe if we had therapies that were aimed at that, they might be beneficial not just to Huntington's disease but to some others as well.
So then is this aggregation of proteins, is that an attack against the system or is it a protection against the system?
So we had done some work several years ago because I think most people assume that since the deposits are they don't appear in normal brains and so they're clearly abnormal, that they must be bad.
Mm-hmm.
But when we developed a fancy microscope that allows us to follow individual neurons over their lifetime and found out that at least the ones you can see, the visible ones, when they grow that big, cells that form them actually live longer than ones that don't.
Mm.
So sort of a surprising result. And it was part of the reason that led us to think that maybe neurons have really important coping mechanisms for dealing with proteins that are prone to aggregate. And forming these large structures anyway might be a way to, in effect, mothball misfolded proteins into structures that might be less troublesome than having the material float around in cells.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about the Tabe-Corre Center, and that was formed in 2009?
Yes.
And how did that come about?
That came about when a Bay Area philanthropist, Mr. Tad Tobe, together with the Corrett Foundation, which is also based in San Francisco, approached me about the possibility of developing a program aimed at developing therapeutics for Huntington's disease. And it fits perfectly with the idea we talked about earlier with the Valley of Death and how difficult it is having an academic laboratory where we make some discoveries that seem very promising but really don't have the means to move those forward to the clinic. And so what we did with them and with their help was to really try to develop a translational center that was aimed at taking the most promising ideas and developing them much the same way a company might, at least the initial steps, so that we could tell whether they really warranted further investment and movement toward clinical development. And so we've constructed a team, including people from the pharmaceutical industry, to help guide us so that we can take some of these discoveries and really work together with companies to try to get them to the point where we might be able to start a clinical trial.
Wonderful. How's that going? And I noticed that there were a few things in the... There was another publication that Anne sent me regarding potentially having a cure for HD by 2020.
Yes, well, we set ourselves an ambitious goal, and we did that for a reason. I think that sometimes the way we in academia approach problems is we sort of want to understand every single little thing about something before we take the next step. And I think that you know, by setting a goal like that that's ambitious, it certainly has helped me think about, realistically, what are the sort of approaches we need to take today to make something like that feasible? And I think that really affected the way we do things, and certainly the way the Translational Center was constructed, so that we've built in strategies that might give us a therapeutic approach even before we understand exactly how every little part works. So it's an ambitious goal, but I think it's also exciting, and I think it really helps people focus. It's a little bit like, you know, saying you want to land someone on the moon. I think it kind of gets everybody's energies and their creative minds really focused on a goal. And I think sometimes that's really helpful for stimulating people to kind of reach as far as they can.
Having the target, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So. Yeah. What are some of the obstacles that you see to moving discoveries to the clinic? Besides money, of course.
There's funding. Funding is certainly, people have suggested, that on average it takes $1 billion to develop a drug. It's hard to know how accurate that number is. Some people have said it's more. But suffice it to say, it takes a lot of financial support to develop a drug, and in particular because of the risks issues in neurodegenerative disease. I think one of the things we would dearly love is to be able to have ways to, and this is what some of the things, this is how stem cells fit in a little bit for us, and fancy technology like the microscope I was describing earlier, ways that we can reduce that risk somewhat so that we can get companies more interested in working on Huntington's disease. I think that if we could make it less risky, then we wouldn't necessarily have to rely so heavily on the NIH to be able to support HD work. It would make more sense for companies. And so that's certainly one of the agendas we have at the center, is to try to make the process less risky so that we have more to offer patients and there will be more investment from outside. So one of the obstacles clearly is funding. Another is just this technical issue of really figuring out, why have we been able to cure the disease several times in mice, but not seem to, why do we struggle so much to get it to work in the clinic? And really trying to figure out what those reasons are and to see if we can tackle them one at a time so that the work we do is more effective. Another is clinical trials, and I think this is where your listeners just want to encourage them to consider getting involved. There has been a big concern because there's been quite a bit of effort to develop therapies. We're working on it. CHDI is working on it. There are several companies that I work with that are working on it. And one concern has been, what if some of these ideas all go to the clinic at once? Will there be enough patients actually to do the clinical trials? And so it's important that, we're all in this together, and to try to all do our parts. And so if you're someone who has HD, to at least consider the possibility of participating in a clinical trial. It's certainly the feasibility of doing a clinical trial is one of the criteria that companies do think about when they think about whether to work in an area.
Right. And we do have a little comment from someone in the chat room, Debbie Bowman. She would like to say hello. And she likes Dr. Finkbeiner. You might know me by the last name Craig.
Yeah, I sure do.
And she says hello.
Yeah, and so so Debbie gives me a great excuse to just say what a wonderful, how lucky I am to work with people like her and the Craig family, which is just fantastic. And
awesome.
And just to say in general, too, that I think the HD community has been terrific in terms of the patient support. It's been you know, it is one of the reasons why I'm, you know, trying my hardest to hang in there, to try to really make a difference.
Oh, we appreciate that so much. Well, so Dr. Finkbeiner, are you currently seeking grant opportunities for research?
Oh, I'm afraid nowadays it's all the time.
Yeah.
Especially the last couple of years, I think, with the sort of some of the things we talked about earlier on, the changes in the economy and a lot of the support agencies. So we do have to devote more and more of our time, unfortunately, to fundraising. Yeah.
Now, what about private donations? Are you open to accepting that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
The Gladstone's a nonprofit institution, and we, as I mentioned, the translational center that we run is almost entirely driven by philanthropy. And one of the things we strive to do is to leverage gifts that we receive. So we have over the last 3 years, been able to leverage the gifts we received from our philanthropists to start the Toby Corrett Center. And we've been successful in raising about $5 for every $1 we receive as a gift. And as you can imagine, that really helps a lot in terms of, you know, making everyone's gift more effective at achieving the goal. And
I apologize for mispronouncing that.
Oh, yeah. I mispronounced it for the first year, so don't feel bad.
So what is next on the agenda for you at Gladstone Institute?
We have lots of irons in the fire. We have a number of small molecules, potential drugs, that stimulate a pathway in neurons to clear misfolded proteins. It's got an awful name called autophagy. yeah, I know. Nothing's easy. But we're excited about it because we discovered it while we were studying Huntington's disease, but we've tested it in a model of another neurodegenerative disease called Lou Gehrig's disease or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and it shows benefits there. And so this is kind of one of those common threads ideas we talked about earlier that makes me very hopeful. And so we're working really hard to, we have a number of companies that are interested in those, and we're also looking, getting support from other areas to see if we can develop those into something that might eventually lead to a clinical trial in Huntington's disease.
Right.
There's another colleague of mine at the Translational Center working on Huntington's disease who has discovered a pathway that helps with inflammation. And he's shown that he's developed some small molecules that also potentially could be drugs that have great benefits in mouse models of Huntington's disease and also in Alzheimer's disease mouse models. And so that's another example of sort of a common thread strategy where we're looking at a pathway that might be beneficial for a couple of diseases and be helpful. So those are a couple of examples of things we're really excited about.
Would that be Dr. Paul Manchowski?
That would be.
He was on the show, too. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Finkbeiner, how can we help? What are some of the ways that we can work better together as a team to help each other with this?
Yeah. Well, I think I can think of three ways, certainly. One is to, for those who are able, and is to think about participating in clinical trials. There are a number of places that people can look for information about what trials are available in their area, and to consider that anyway. The faster...
That's just that enough, right? I mean, that's without... clinical trials without the research, we can't go forward, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we can work all day in the lab and find things that look great in mice, but if we can't, if people aren't available to do the clinical trial, then we will never know. And
right.
And the way clinical trials are done, there are these things called eligibility criteria, and, you know, it's nothing personal. It's just that whenever someone constructs a trial, sometimes they have certain things that... that patients, criteria that patients have to meet, whether they've been on a medication, certain medication before or not, or whether they have certain symptoms or not. So we can't always take everyone who wants to participate either. That's why it's so important that as many people at least become available as possible, so that these trials can be completed and we can learn from them. And hopefully something great will come out of the trial, but at least we'll learn from them so that we can do a better job the next time. So that's, I'd say, one obvious area. Another, it sounds like a cliche, but, you know, to try to encourage your representatives to support the NIH. They do listen to people, and it still remains the single biggest source for academic basic science research in Huntington's disease. And the better we understand the mechanisms of Huntington's disease, the more attractive it'll be to potential industry partners for really developing good therapies to the disease. So it still plays a really important role.
We have a question.
And then the third would just be financial support, that for those in the community who can, philanthropy, as I said, plays a critical role for us in our efforts to try to move things we discover in the lab to the clinic.
Okay, great. We have a question. James, you want to give us the question or a comment?
Sure. Kimberly Spears asks, does the doctor see a better medicine or medicines or a cure in the near future?
Well, what I can say is that I have I've been working in Huntington's disease since about 1997, and I've really seen the field transform over those years. CHDI has certainly helped develop a clinical trial network that wasn't there before, and I've noticed, especially in the last few years, an increased interest by companies in Huntington's disease. And so I am aware of a number of potential therapies that are in the pipeline or where clinical trials have been planned. So it's always tough, you know, to make any predictions about when we'll have something better to offer people. But there's never been another time in my career where I've seen so many promising things in the works. So I'm still at this point cautiously optimistic that that hopefully we'll have better things soon.
Right. Okay. We do have another question, James. I don't know if you see this question or not in the chat room, from Carolyn. She says, many donations are not fully used for research. What percent of donations actually go to research?
Well, I can't answer that in a general way. I can say that certainly every dollar we receive goes for the research that we propose to do. I think that is one of the nice things about being at an institute where we're financially independent. And I think part of it too, it's a little confusing sometimes exactly how the accounting's done, but I can at least reassure your listeners that, that's where our support goes.
Great. And if somebody wanted to send in a donation to the Gladstone Institute, how would they do that?
So we have we have a website. I think probably if people just Google Gladstone Institute, they'll be able to get there. It gives you the Gladstone Institute. And we have a section on giving and or just contact us where people can, there's a donation section on the front page.
Okay.
That's probably the easiest thing. And if you just, in the note, make sure that it goes to Huntington's disease, that's one way. And people are welcome to email me, too, if they'd like to hear about what we're doing or would like sort of to make sure their donation goes to a project that they are really interested in. That also can be, you know, I can give people, then it still will go to the Gladstone, but I can at least make sure it gets to us and is used for what they want.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, have we left anything out? Because we're getting short on time. And I know you have some more to go here in a couple minutes. So Did we leave anything out? Anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners?
I just would love to, you know, we had this, Melissa, you and I had this conversation kind of before the interview started. I'm so inspired by these social media tools that have been created. And I really wish we could harness them more effectively. I think it's, you've done a terrific job using this as an outlet for communicating with the HD community and getting information out there so that they can understand HD better and get some of their questions answered. But I would love to think with your listeners creatively about ways to really harness these tools better to, you know, to work together as a team to really conquer the disease. So not just as an information outlet, but to really work as a way to. And I think so. I would challenge your listeners to think of creative ways. Maybe they can even can think of ideas to send you of ways that we can, you know, really harness these tools as a grassroots effort. Because in the end, I sort of feel like, you know, we're in this together. It's us, patients who have the disease, and the people who are really working hard to try to find cures. You know, together we've got to do it. And so if there's a way that we can think about how to harness these tools, I think that would be really exciting.
Well, I think because we are working with our own loved ones who are affected by the disease, we are really motivated to make things happen a lot quicker and more streamlined maybe.
Yeah, you guys are motivated, and you have, you know, there's so many different skill sets out there, too, and so, you know, different people with different creative ideas, things I wouldn't think about, you know, and you know, you want me actually working on the science anyway, so I think, you know, if we can just get tap into some of the amazing resources that exist in the HD community to, you know, come up with maybe whole new models for how to work together to support this work, cross that valley of death, that would be really exciting.
Yeah, that's, you know, we have James Valvano, he's my producer. I mean, he's done amazing work just from his home, even after having his computer wiped out. I mean, he's developed this Help for HD app for phones, iPhones and Android, the first ever app for HD. And so, you know, we like you said, we do have a across-the-board variety of skill sets among the grassroots organizations that are popping up. And, you know, we really do need to work together to make these things happen and to get communication around the world. So having the technology is great, but then making the tools to reach across the, you know, the international market or whatever you want to call it is another thing. So we're just fortunate that we have people that have these skills and we can work together to accomplish great things. So now I think we need to take a break, and I don't know if you can stay with us, Dr. Finkbeiner, if you have to leave, but we will take a quick break and then we'll come back with announcements and any other questions. If anybody has any questions, I don't know if you have to leave us right away.
I have a 4:30 appointment, Melissa, but I'll stay on the line in case they don't show up or in case they're a little late.
Okay.
I may have to leave you, though.
Okay. Well, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll be right back, everyone. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in.
Here's an oldie but a goodie. We'll return.
Thank you. Thank you. That is an oldie but goodie. We are back. Welcome back to the HD View with Dr. Stephen Finkbeiner and the Toby Corrett Center for Huntington's Disease Research. This is Melissa, your host, and tonight our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. We are taking questions still from the Help for HD chat room and Facebook Live chat tonight. Now, in the event that you're listening to this recorded version, and you have questions and want to ask Dr. Finkbeiner questions, send them to me at Melissa at helphd-international.org, and I will definitely get these questions to him. We've got some announcements. James, I don't know if we had announcements from DeShalmar tonight, but I know you have a really, really exciting announcement.
Okay, sorry about that. Too many pages up.
Okay.
I was pleased to find out that Movement for Hope, which is a fantastic website, if you just visit movementforhope.org, they're in the UK, and they are supporting the Huntington's Disease Project, and they will be doing a spread coming soon, hopefully soon, regarding the team, the project, and the future of the project. So it was absolutely amazing for them to endorse and support the project. So more information will follow, hopefully, within the next couple of days, but it's been awesome.
Great. And a quick overview of the project for everyone, in case...
I don't think there's anything quick about that.
Okay.
Every day we're waking up to so many emails, and I just want to say to everyone, if I have not gotten back to you, I apologize. It's just been overwhelming. Great, but overwhelming. We are coming up to close to 5,000 views alone in English, over 30 countries, 7 languages now. So every morning when we wake up and we see the staff coming in, it's just amazing with the amount of support that we're getting. So hopefully next Monday we'll know more.
This is the Huntington's Disease Film Project. It's international. James has a trailer up on his website, wehaveafaith.org. Go to feature, right,
yeah.
James? And
yep.
Check
they
out the trailer.
Choose whatever language they need it in.
Right. Okay, super. And then do we have anything from DeShalmar tonight?
I believe next week.
Okay, good. And then don't forget endhd.org. We are supporting Dr. Jan Nolte's research. 100% of the donations that go to that website will go directly to her project. I'd also like to mention that I am working on a website called researchforhd.org, and we will be putting researchers on that website who would like to get direct donations sent to them. So maybe Dr. Finkbeiner might be interested in that as well. Upcoming shows, real quick, May 29, Help for HD News channel with Stu Blatt. He's a PT, physical therapist. June 4, the HDV with Ask Dr. Goodman show. June 11, the HDV with Meta O'Rear. June 18, the HDV with Dr. Beth John. June 25, the HDV Reach to HD, and Prana will be coming back on with an update. In case anybody out there has any other questions, please contact me at Melissa at helphd-international.org. And I think we need to conclude the show tonight. I do want to thank Dr. Stephen Finkbeiner from the Gladstone Institute and Toby Corrett Center for Huntington's Disease Research. Dr. Finkbeiner, thank you so much for coming on the show. Appreciate you so much. And don't forget to contact me at helphdinternational.org. Find us on Facebook, Help for HD, the HD View. And please come back and listen to the recorded episode, send it out to your friends, family, and colleagues, and get the free On the Road Help for HD app as well at helpforhdinternational.org. We have a face.org. And anything else, James, that I left out? I can't remember.
Nope, I think it comes up.
And Dr.
Sinclair,
thank you so much for spending this time with us today. We really appreciate you.
It was my pleasure, Melissa.
Great. Have a good meeting. We'll talk to you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, everyone.